From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's our renewable diesel special. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk a lot about renewable diesel and the way soybeans, other vegetable oils, may be used in the future as related to legislation that Congress passed a couple of times in the 2000s. These are the pieces of legislation that brought ethanol into place as part of the gasoline supply and now bringing other advanced fuels online. And we'll do all of that on this edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Have you signed up yet for the Illinois Farm Economics Series, the IFAS online webinars? I hope so, but if not, no worries. Two of them have been completed, one of them earlier today with Nick Paulson and Gary Schnitke. Last week, Joe Jansen and Scott Irwin were up. Those are already in the archive, but there are four more left to go, and you can join the Farm Doc team each Thursday at 11 a.m. by signing up at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. It's quick, it's simple, and it's easy to do. We'll also try to post into our website a link as well. You can find that, of course, at Illinois Public Media at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org. Now, speaking of Scott Irwin, a few weeks ago, U.S. EPA announced the renewable value obligations for the coming year as it's related to all renewable fuels, including ethanol, but more importantly, renewable diesel. Today, we'll explore that part of the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard. We'll start by hearing an interview that I did with Scott Irwin not long after the RVOs were announced. I asked first if he could explain how this is incorporated into the legislation.
Previous years were under, we had a starting point of a table of targeted volumes that were written directly into the statute for the mandate levels. Those ended with the 2022 calendar year. So this is the first set of RVOs under what's known as the big reset, where the EPA had much more discretion about setting the volumes because there weren't specific targets now that they had to meet. There were only broad criteria in the law about how to set the RVO volumes post-2022, and this is the first one.
And this is just a reminder that the law, the RFS, the Renewable Fuel Standard, does not sunset?
And that is a very important point that a lot of people have misunderstood. There is no sunset. Until the U.S. Congress amends, repeals the RFS, and the president signs off on that, we will have annual RVOs under the RFS forever.
And this puts... Well, one more question for you as it related to this, and it's about ethanol usage, which is not mandated, but generally for corn. How does this differ from previous year? Because it's not just 1 year this time around, it's 3 years, and it also looks back.
Correct. So, you know, it's a three-year set of RVOs to give the biofuels industry and obligated parties in the energy industry some sense of, over a multi-year horizon, what the RVOs are going to be. And then the look back is, you know, we're still dealing with the what is called vacate and remand in 2017 of, I believe it was the 2016 RVO, or it was 2015, I don't remember the specific year, where there was a cut of 500 million gallons in the conventional, and the court said you got to put it back in. So here we are all these years later, and we're going to add 250 million a year to, I think, 23 and 24, or it's 24 and 25, I can't remember which 2 years, to finally make up for those illegally waived gallons way back in the past.
Oh, so that's why there's a 15 billion gallon for 2023, but 15.25 for 24 and 15.25 billion gallon obligation for 2025 then.
That's right. So they did it in the back 2 years. That's exactly what it is. They split it across 2 years. And so you're making up the illegally waived gallons based on the 2017 court decision. And so the biodiesel, or the, excuse me, the ethanol industry can thank one Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh for those gallons, because he's the one that gave them to him.
On the release of the RVOs, which, by the way, won't really be finalized until June or July of 2023, the trade saw it as negative to the soybean market because it had expected a much larger number. What was your assessment?
Well, I think it's all a matter of perspective. Apparently, the market has been baking in huge demand for renewable diesel, kind of a build it and they will come mentality. And they thought basically that all of these massive expansion plans for renewable diesel apparently would be recognized in the RVO numbers starting in 2023 and then 24 and 25, that you know, you'd have to have big increases in the advanced biofuel and biomass-based diesel RVOs to, you know, justify the expansion in RD and the lofty veg oil values. My own personal view is, wow, I've been standing on a different planet apparently than everybody else, because that never made sense to me. And I've never thought that that was going to happen. And I take a completely different view on these RVOs than what apparently was baked into the markets.
Anything else on the RVO, the renewable volumes obligation released by EPA, which will be the guide for their use in 2023, 2024, and 2025?
I'm surprised that the RVOs released are as positive as they are. I think it's a real victory that the RVOs, you know, 15 billion gallons for the conventional plus the remand 500 million gallons. I'm looking at that going, man, that could have been a lot worse based on recent history. Now, I recognize that's not what was baked into the market, particularly the veg oil market. This is an example where I don't know, you know, what those folks were smoking, if they really thought all those RD plants were going to get built and use that much soybean oil. I never bought into that scenario.
That was an interview I did with Scott Irwin just after the RFS renewable volume obligations were released by US EPA in late November. I also talked with a couple of other agricultural economists, including Ed Ossett, about this particular issue. Ed is from University of Minnesota Extension.
Well, I don't know about the policy end of it. I mean, I'm not knee deep in the policy end of it. All I know is that the industry is looking forward to a big expansion. And the latest count I have is something like 14 or 15, maybe even 16 announced expansions or new soy crushing facilities that are going to be built in the next 1 to 4 years. They're all over the country, primarily in the Corn Belt, but all over the country. And this expansion, I mean, if it happens, this is a big question, if they all happen, this is going to be a fundamental change in U.S. agriculture. And I'm not sure where it's going, but if you want to expand crush capacity, and these 16 plants, the math says that crush capacity will increase by something like 25%. That's a big number. That's a big number, Todd. And it, to me, it has echoes of the ethanol, the growth and expansion in the ethanol industry 10, 15 years ago, where it was growing so fast, demanding so many corn acres to supply the ethanol industry, that it upset all markets. It upset the soybean market, the wheat market, every market, because we only have so many acres And I've been doing some math. You want to see my math?
I do.
I'm kind of conservative. If, in fact, the crushing industry expands by 25%, based on current U.S. crush of 2.2 billion bushels, it means 500 to 600 million more bushels are needed of soybeans. You take that, divide by 52 bushels per acre. We need something like 10 and a half, 11 million more acres of soybeans to supply that. I've heard different thoughts on that. One thought, well, we won't be exporting to China, or we'll export a lot less to China. That's how we will feed these plants. And I'm like, well, it's not really that simple. You know, you have to compete for that. Maybe China's willing to pay more for those soybeans. And this is going to have a positive impact. And you know what? My 10 to 11 million more acres of soybeans is conservative. I see U.S. Wheat Associates put out something at the end of September, and their little study says we need 20 to 25 million more acres of soybeans. That's a hell of a lot of soybean acres. CoBank put something out about the same time, again, end of September. And they're pretty specific. We need to stop exporting, theoretically, and plant another 17.9 million acres. You know, I'm not sure where this is going, Todd, but any one of those scenarios is upsetting the soybean market, putting a lot of activity into the soybean market, and that will spill over to corn, to wheat, to barley, to cotton, whatever you want to talk about. It's going to be an interesting 2 to 4 years ahead of us.
So probably not if, but will they build. Even if they build half of them, it's a big number.
It's a big number. And again, this is echoes of the ethanol expansion of 15 years ago, where when ethanol was expanding, people would look at me and someone might say, boy, this is going to upset the corn market. And I'm like, hey, this goes beyond corn. We only have so many acres. If you want to plant more corn, that means less of something else, and that impacts those markets. Well, the same thing going on here. If we want more soybean acres, and by the way, close to 90 million acres of soybeans, which is about as many as we've ever planted. I have a hard time imagining 100 to 110 or more million acres of soybeans. Where do those acres come from?
Do we offset the exports by exporting meal rather than whole soybean?
I suppose that's that's a very interesting thought right there. I mean, meal, this whole expansion is being driven by the oil market, not the meal market, and renewable diesel and things like that. It's an oil-driven expansion, and meal buyers can probably look forward to some decent prices in the years ahead. Yeah, that could happen. There's a whole lot of it could go this way, it could go that way, and it'll be fun to sit back and watch it.
Well, I wonder about that because, of course, Argentina we think of as a meal exporter, not a whole soybean exporter, generally speaking. How hard would it be, for instance, for the PNW to convert to meal exports rather than whole soybeans?
Well, the meal is not easily transported. There's probably got to be some heavy investment into pelletizing and doing it in a way that it travels well. So that's going to take some investment, too, if you want to go that route or if the industry wants to go that route. But you know what? It sounds like something that would probably happen, probably got to happen.
Yeah, so the other thing is extra acres would come from where? Do we talk about more soybean acres in regions of Kansas that can handle the soybean? Does the South give up some cotton acres to make this happen? And is there a primary shift in Illinois, Iowa, and the Dakotas?
That's why it'll be so much fun. All of the above. I want to say all of the above. All of the above. The Dakotas have been expanding soybean acres for several decades now, and they probably got room for more. Kansas, as you mentioned, room for more. Steal some cotton away, acres away from the Delta. I think that'll happen. All of the above. All of the above. And it'll have an impact throughout the Corn Belt.
Clearly that is and has been the expectation within the trade for more than a year now. That's Ed Usset, of course, from University of Minnesota Extension. He mentioned the Dakotas, and I talk to Frayne Olson regularly as well, if you listen to the programs, once a month. He's an agricultural economist from North Dakota State University Extension. Last month, I asked him about renewable diesel and a trend he's seen as it relates to the PNW, the Pacific Northwest export market, where he says the soybean exports to China have flattened out. I wondered, as you heard me ask Ed Usset, if there would be an opportunity for that system to change to export bean meal, offsetting some of the issues related to adding acres of soybeans in the United States. But I first asked him about conditions on the ground and plants under construction or planned for his area.
That is a hotly debated topic, yes. And we do have one plant that is currently under construction. ADM put a facility up about 100 miles west of Fargo. There's another plant that's being they're working on it right now. They're starting to put together some of the moving some dirt, etc. That's in a small town about 30 miles west of Fargo. And then there was recently an announcement of a plant that was scheduled originally for the Minnesota, kind of northwest Minnesota area, but it's now been moved, location moved into Grand Forks, which is about 80 miles north of Fargo. All of these are going to be very large commercial size facilities, you know, spending between $300-400 million to put them up. They're all going after this potential for renewable diesel fuel. There's actually five additional crush plants in Canada that are being built for canola, also trying to tap into the U.S. renewable diesel fuel market or renewable fuels market. So there's a lot of activity here in the northern area for both soybeans as well as corn. You know, these plants are large enough that they are going to chew up a large portion of our existing crops. So the expectation is we'll have not only an increase in acreage base, we're counting pretty heavily on the trend line yields to help us out as well.
Secondary question. I take it most of these plants are built to service the California market to begin with, and more likely, is there enough rail to pull all of that off?
Yes, there is. You know, and that's one of the things our region up here is set up, it is better for rail. We did have some rail disruption issues back in 2013, 2014. Where you know, to some degree there was some weather issues on the grain side, but also the grain rail space was competing with some of the oil space. So we were taking grain in the eastern portion of the state and pushing it west. We were taking crude oil from the western portion of the state and pushing it east into the refineries for the primarily the gasoline and diesel fuel market. And, you know, you think about a one-way road, you know, somebody's got to give, somebody has to push, you know, go off on a siding and be able to let the other trains pass. So we did have some congestion issues several years ago, but those have now been basically straightened out. We've got some additional pipelines that have been put in for the oil. There has been areas that have been double tracked. The railroads have also spent a lot of money putting in additional sidings to allow more trains to be able to meet partway, to be able to regulate the flow. So the rail capacity is there. Obviously, we're still worried about engines and crews and making sure that the railroads in general are running as efficiently as possible. But we have the rail capacity to handle both the soybean oil and the crude oil part of it, as well as the meal. But the question is, you know, where do we ship it to? So the first plant, the ADM plant in Spiritwood, North Dakota, which is again about 100 miles west, that's actually co-owned by Marathon Oil. About 25% of that facility is going to be owned by Marathon, and there's already a contract in place where the vegetable oil from that plant will be sent out to Western North Dakota to a small refinery that's already been retrofitted to handle renewable diesel. So all the vegetable oil is going to go out to Western North Dakota, get refined, and then go from there into the California market. For the other facilities, the ones that are now being planned and kind of finalized, we don't have as clear a picture on who's going to refine the oil, because the raw vegetable oil coming out of a plant still needs to be refined to a higher level to be able to take out the impurities. And that still has to be run through a refinery to be able to convert it from a vegetable oil into renewable diesel fuel. So there's still some logistical questions on where exactly all that's going to go and who's going to be purchasing it. But my understanding is there's a demand base for it, and it is going to hit the California market. That's the primary target audience.
Do you expect the bean meal will provide a livestock boon in the area of a different sort?
There is that conversation going on as well. In fact, here at the university, we just added a brand new position within our extension section for livestock development, anticipating that there will be this opportunity, that we're going to have adequate feed supplies now, and that will hopefully open up some opportunities to expand livestock and livestock production in the region. I think there will be some of that occurs, obviously. But I think that the demand is going to grow a lot faster, or excuse me, the supply is going to grow a lot faster than the demand. The crush plants are going to come on a lot quicker than we're going to be able to expand our livestock sector. And so the expectation right now is a lot of that soybean meal is going to be headed towards the West Coast. I know AGP, which is one of the large crushing companies here in the U.S., also has some export facilities in the PNW. They're growing and expanding those facilities to try and handle a larger volume of soybean meal, primarily targeting the South Asia market, not necessarily China per se, but more of the South Asian countries, that there is a demand base for meal. They have an interest in that, and they don't have the domestic crush capacity to be able to handle raw soybeans. So I know there's a lot of questions about market development and where is all the meal going to go, but my opinion, my assessment is that I think there is an international demand for that, primarily in the South Asia region. We do have to worry about logistics and making sure we have the handling capacity to deal with the larger volumes. Because it is a powder, it has some different characteristics. You have to have a little bit different handling equipment. Doesn't flow quite as easily as a grain would flow. And so there has to be some adjustments made, especially from an export standpoint, to handle larger volumes and make sure that you're able to load and unload that product as easily or as quickly and as efficiently as possible. So the facilities that right now handle grain do have to be modified a bit to be able to handle meal efficiently.
Brian Olson is with North Dakota State University Extension, joined us here on the Closing Market Report for our renewable diesel special, along with agricultural economist Scott Irwin from Illinois and Ed Ussett from Minnesota. I'm Todd Gleason.